So today we have my good colleague and friend, Herr Mundur. So, thanks, Dietmar.
And just a footnote, you can just attend individual sessions if you can't come every Monday night, you know, just come listen to Rebecca or just come and listen to Dr. Jenis, right? So you don't have to sign up for a whole semester worth of Monday night, but you're more than welcome to do that as well, or come as it fits into your schedule.
Although we will take note of it.
An article will appear in a newspaper. Otherwise, nothing major. So.
Why don't they care for all creation? But only for this feast.
Anyhow, it's an intriguing topic, being restored to finitude. I didn't know what it meant, but then...
We never know what my titles mean.
No. Shouldn't be a big challenge. That's why people come to your classes, I think, is they're trying to figure out what does that actually mean. When we were talking about this series with David and Rajan, David says, oh yeah, well... you know, I love Ernest Becker's Denial of Death. I've never read it, but it's an intriguing title and book. And so he forced me to reread this. You can borrow it at any time. But it is an amazing book. So Ernest Becker, it came out in 1974. He won the Pulitzer Prize for it in 1974, and he died in 1974. He already had jawbone cancer as he was writing this. It's not an autobiography. It's not an easy. You wouldn't have a clue that he is personally dying when you're reading it. He reflects on the thought of Freud, of Otto Rank, so the people who broadened Freud, because Freud was brilliant in his insight, but reductionistic, right? There's way more than sort of sexual things going on, and so his students broadened it. So Rank, Jung, Adler broadened his understanding, and as some of you know, when Jung challenged Freud, Freud fainted away. So in terms of denial of death, that was his own way. His perpetuating his own ideas was his way of trying to deny death. And so when his own disciples challenged that, he couldn't actually handle it too well. What makes Ernst Becker distinct, though, is he has a real appreciation of, you know, he calls these scientific insights, also of how, and he uses Kierkegaard's work a lot, and Otto Rank, etc., that actually humans do ultimately need some kind of leap of faith. And that's what he develops on the basis of Kierkegaard, to deal with the complexity of what humans actually are, what human life is. To be restored to finitude, we'll have to deal, first of all, with the denial a bit, and I'll talk a bit about the denial of death then. Obviously, this would be a four-part series or something, and I'll try to talk only 20 minutes so we can get into conversation. And then, though, I will use a tiny bit of the insights of Wendell Berry, just his reflection on King Lear, actually, in a piece called The Body and the Earth. In King Lear, there is a restoration to finitude, and it's Earl of Gloucester. Basically, he has to die to his false self to be reborn as a limited human being. So that's the model I will try to follow. But so first of all, in terms of our culture, definitely is in denial of death. And I mean, we're not unique. Other cultures have been that, and we've just done it in different versions. But if you look, so we can look at it personally, and we can look at it socially. I'll start with the large scale, the social political. Every political party so far still commits themselves to economic growth. We're in a finite planet. We're finite humans, and unlimited debt growth simply cannot work. And so our most common public discourse, like every day on the media, right? So everybody is steeped in this. We're actually denying that we're finite. is that from denying that we are individually finite and limited beings on a limited planet. So we are basically death-defying, and of course death catches up, right? Because you ultimately can't successfully deny death, but we're death-defying, and then we forget the death of the oceans, the death of the forests, the death of the, you know, of so many of the cultures, the death of communities, and of course the amazing exploitation of individuals around the world. So the amount of slavery that exists today is higher than when slavery was legal, and people who are enslaved, or Pat and I just got this book by Chris Hedges called Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. So he goes with an artist, Joe Sacco, I think his name, a graphic artist, and he goes through the U.S. and shows the sacrifice zones of this debt-led economy. And so whole areas have been totally wiped out in the States. So he goes from Ohio, and then he goes to the southern states to some of the migrant workers. So this is all a death-denying culture. And, of course, those who make the decisions often don't see the death that they are inflicting. Right? But, you know, and so it's very nice for us, of course, to blame industry and government. The issue is we are intimately involved in the same thing. And so, you know, we can be very critical. Our, you know, our dominant cultural pattern of trying to deny death is consumerism. And we can all complain about it, and we all heavily participate. Right? And so then the question is, well, why do we participate? Right? So why do we somehow buy in that somehow our life has to be a bit more comfortable, a bit more convenient, a bit, you know, better in this way and a bit better in that way? And so, for example, what happens? Okay, so we, let's say, get a fuel-efficient car, you know, in this case a hybrid, or we put in solar panels, so we save a bit of money. And what do you do with that saved money? You spend it. And therefore, you're keeping on putting the same burden on the environment, on other people, on life, right? Because it just carries on. William Risu was the founder of the ecological, of the notion of the ecological footprint at UBC, would say, well, what you should do with the money that you've saved is burn it. That's the best thing to acknowledge how limited we are as a people and as a planet. Otherwise, you're just going to keep on the same burden. Or, in another way of saying it, you buy a more energy efficient car, therefore you just drive further. Because it costs you less, right? So you actually haven't acknowledged, no, we are actually limited and on a limited planet. Better than burning probably is you could give that money, and people have calculated it would be about 50% of what we in the middle class earn we would have to give, you know, whether to charity, to ecological causes, or whatever, just give it away, get into the habit of giving it away. So why don't we do that? Right, and so this is where we have to go back to, if you want, Freud, Kierkegaard, and our childhood. Humans are weird creatures. On the one hand, we are bodily creatures that live and die in a very complex world. Right? But on the other hand, we are symbol-making creatures. We also live in a universe of meaning. But our life has to somehow hang together. We have to find meaning, and we want to belong to something larger than ourselves. And as far as we know, I mean, Jane Goodall has done a lot of works on chimps, and they can do all sorts of things. But most of them don't worry about their death. Like, it's a unique thing about humans, that we, in fact, as we face the world and how complex it is, right, and how instantly somebody could die, right now, Dylan's... girlfriend's brother, you know, Isaac Carnelson, you probably saw it in the paper, you know, got killed by a cement truck. You know, was it not 2 weeks ago? Funeral was, I think, on Sunday. Right, here's a 21-year-old, very promising, amazing, you know, and in a second, that person is dead. You know, so that's the, and humans can be aware of that. And of course, when it hits close, like it hits to your sibling, it hit my sibling, my brother, Holger, when he was 27. You know, I'm about 4 or 5 years old or whatever. You know, so as humans, we can be aware of that. And so the state of dread, in a certain sense, is a common you know, or terror at the complexity of the world. In children, you see it in their nightmares. There's a certain age at which nightmares start. Right? And then as parents, we come and say, oh, everything will be okay. And we need that. That's definitely an important thing. But what it develops is that we actually have, within parents or whoever cares for us, we have the magical helpers. I mean, all we have to do is cry, right? And they change our diapers, they, you know, keep us warm, they hold us, whatever. And, of course, when we get into the age of language, we learn, and depending on how skilled the parents are, to manipulate to get these magical helpers, you know, to do what we need them to do for us, what we think we need them to do for us. And this magical helper notion then we carry on into adulthood, and we project it often. You know, I mean, Hitler is only, unfortunately, we should have gotten rid of Hitler, because people always think it's only, you know, it's Germans. Well, you know, I've got obviously good German background, and Ellen, so, and Bright Cross, of course, you're safe, but Dale, you know, is totally infected. As if it's, you know, particularly, you know, the particular power of a Hitler or the particular weakness of German people. It's the human condition to project. You want to be loyal to your nation. I mean, look at all the nationalism south of the border. And look at Harper with his celebration of the war of 1812 and using $29 million, wanting to us to be into that same kind of idea, you know, my nation, you know, I'm proud of my nation. So that's what you're supposed to sacrifice. So that's becomes your new magical helper. Your nation state is your magical helper. Right? So you project. And all of you who are counselors, you know the phenomenon of transference. So what was either good or bad in your childhood, right? Because if you had dysfunctional childhood, you often, your trust in these helpers didn't work. And so you often become even more vulnerable for looking for magical helpers as you grow up. Right? And so this transference, for good or ill, is one way that we try to also then deny death, right? We want to live in this universe where things are kept safe, you know, and we can manipulate the universe for our purposes, so that, you know, the world doesn't overwhelm us with dread. And that's what we do with consumerism, or whatever the dominant pattern of our culture is. We think, okay, well, if we follow into these patterns, this is how we get recognition. You know, it could be through achievement, any number of things, right? It could be through achievement, through what we have, any number of things. We think, okay, now we've got a universe of meaning that'll keep us safe. And a lot of people will basically ignore that they are both bodily limited dying creatures and creatures who need meaning and who need to belong to something larger. Right? And so they say, well, I won't even stick my head up. I'll just stay within. This is what our culture says we should do. That's my eternity project. And the eternity project could even be, well, sure, oh yeah, we all know we have to die, but we refuse to actually then become authentic selves, to become humans. We just live within the safe confines of what somebody has defined for us, in this case, the dominant culture around us. So we can all come up with our own ways of denying, you know, denying death by trying to find a solution. So just very quickly, how Kierkegaard spelled it out, and he says, well, we are a duality of, well, he's more poetic, so on the one hand, to be a self, we are yoked to Pegasus, to the flying horse, and that is our, if you want, mind, soul, whatever word you want to put in there, because all you have to do is imagine it, and it's there, right? Like all of you, or most of you, could probably imagine lying on a warm, sunny beach somewhere right now. You can be instantly there, or 1 second delay. But to actually get there would be another thing, right? And so we have this winged horse of endless possibility, or of infinity, and on the other hand, we are yoked to a plodding nag, which is necessity, which is reality, which is body, which is earth. And what a ride. You know, yourself has to steer these two, this flying horse and this plodding nag, somehow through life. And most people just let one side dominate the other. So you can say, well, the plodding nag determines anything. There are no possibilities. I can't do anything. So that's, if you want, the posture of despair. Right? And Kierkegaard unfolds that's actually our sickness unto death. This is our spiritual sickness unto death because we deny that there's spirit. We deny that there's possibility. We deny that we have choices, right? Or we go the other way and just live, you know, it's the sin of pride if you want, but you live in, I can do anything I want. And I think that's a dominant message for the yuppie class, for our university students. You know, that's what parents and culture has been drilling in. You know, regardless of your disabilities, you can be anything you want. Bull. You know? But it sounds good. And so then, and of course, you know, just work hard enough, try hard enough. In other words, again, you know, ignore your actual limits and your combination between that you have possibility and that plodding nag, reality, body, earth, place in life. Right? And so people will vacillate to the one or to the other. One version of that he describes, the version of pride, or the sin of pride, as he was called it. It means you're cutting yourself off from your own reality when he talks about the sin of pride, is what he calls the self-chosen self. So it's people say, I want to be Caesar or nothing. Right? If I can't be Caesar, if I can't be the boss of the company, I won't even start. Right? Or in a humbler version, somebody who is in their own mind is an amazing football player but never shows up for the tryouts. Because he never wants to test the actuality, you know, how good am I really? But in my own mind, oh, well, I could have had any position, you know, but that was beneath me to, you know, come with these stupid, you know, tryouts and practices and whatever, right? So it's that ongoing, you know, between giving in or in this losing yourself in this endless cloud of fancy. Now, how can you actually live acknowledging that you are a bodily dying creature? So in a life that is what used to be, what is it, nasty, brutish, and short? The Middle Ages was aware of that. The Middle Ages had a universe of meaning where you would say, our life is constantly surrounded by death. Our role is to fulfill our calling, and defined in the Christian Middle Ages, our calling is to serve others. Regardless of how long or how short our life is, and ultimately, I'm not measuring myself by what society thinks or what others think, my forum of accountability is God. Right? And so people had a very, if you want, a secure structure, but it acknowledged, it had the limitedness of humans, and at the same time, you can be part of something much larger than yourself, which is not the state, which is not consumerism, which is not my recognition, my status, or all of these kind of things. So Kierkegaard said, well, how can you actually ride through life? And this is where he says you need the leap of faith. You have to ground yourself, he says, in love in creation. You know, he says the force that made us, or the creative force that made us, this weird combination of endless possibility and strong, finite limitations. Right? So he said you have to ground yourself. And he struggled for a good part of his life and said, well, it's a leap, right? Ultimately, it's a leap of faith to say, ultimately, I will commit myself to loving kindness in creation. And then I can accept that I am this weird mixture. So I won't deny my bodiliness, my deathliness, nor will I deny my possibilities. I won't deny that I need to belong, but I also won't deny my individuality. Right? And some people want individuality at the cost of community. Or you emerge totally in a community, we would call it a gang maybe, in a closed circle, and have no individuality left. Right? And he says, no, neither of those. You need both individuality and belonging. Both necessity, finiteness, body, earth, worm food. You know, Shakespeare was still very good at this, right? So not only the Middle Ages, but he's got whole sonnets of us as being, you know, the food for worms, and how fun it is for humans, how they strut along the stage of human life. By the way, Mexico has a beautiful way still of including that. So they have, on the Day of the Dead, on November the 2nd, they have calaveras. So you make masks, basically the skull. So you have somebody in all their finery, in pomp and circumstance, but you see their skull and their bones beneath all their finery. So, of course, Diego Rivera has the most famous in the Alameda in Mexico City. there's this amazing whatever, it's larger than this whole room, drawing of all the famous people of Mexico of his time, but all seen in their death mask, and then, you know, all their strutting and whatever, and you see, well, hey, this, yeah, aren't we funny, human beings, you know? And so, and another way of doing it is to write a calavera, is you write poetry where you roast each other. You make fun of, you know, our pretensions, our little eternity projects. You just make fun of them, you know. And you, obviously, you do it lovingly, you know, kind of. I mean, Diego Rivera has a bit of an edge when he does it, but you can make fun of your friends to remind us, hey, we are mortal beings, right? So there is a tradition. Of course, the other nice thing about the Day of the Dead as a ritual is you actually talk to and about all the people who have died that year, and then you can go to other people in the past. So that's one way of recalling the community that we are mortal, you know, and whatever. But so you usually light a candle, and for each person that has passed away, and in some of the villages, it's amazing how many candles. And our friend Miguel, a Canadian teacher who lives down there permanently, he was so upset the first time we saw that. They should be saving that money. They should be buying good blankets because they were in leaky houses and shelters and whatever. A year later, he stayed in the village, Tlambacasapan. His dad had just died, and he bought his candle. He sat there, you know, and he was talking, you know, about his dad to the people, but he was also talking at his dad. You know, why did you have to leave me? You were way too young to go, et cetera, et cetera. Right? But you do it in community. So they have still found, and of course the Irish used to have it, the Middle Ages, actually the big religious traditions have ways of reminding us, you know, in the Christian tradition, remember you are dust and to dust you shall return, right? So there's ongoing reminders. Anyway, just very briefly then, Wendell Berry, I think it's worth reading his novels or his short stories. The nicest selection actually I would recommend is called A Distant Land. Very slow moving, it's amazing. But that's the beauty of it. He takes all the little details of life seriously. So he talks, just one example, he talks about either Toll Proudfoot, I guess is his name. And he says he has 98 acres. He doesn't even want to get up to 100 acres. Okay, that's my land. That's what I inherited. I will do a good job of farming this. And then in one of the families, the one son wants to have a better life. The dad co-signs with his farm the loan. The son blows it, and he loses what three generations have had of land. And, of course, the dad can't live with it and ultimately ends his own life. He can't face that. So Wendell Berry is very, very careful in showing how finite we are and how precious it is to preserve what we have within our finite thing. But anyhow, so here in a, he's of course, he was also a prof of English literature, and so he's just as steeped in Shakespeare and in all the other poets. He got to Stanford before he went back to his farm in Kentucky. And so he shows, and that's the last thing I'll do, is the Earl of Gloucester was, through his pride, but amongst other things, betrayed by his son. So it's the play within the play. So King Lear and Cordelia is the big story, and King Lear's pride, which ends tragically. But Gloucester, who also was betrayed, gets physically blinded, but of course he's spiritually blind to his own life, and he, through this betrayal, and he, you know, his eternity project has failed, wants to commit suicide. His other son, Edmund, plays a crazy person, a bedlamite, and so he meets him somewhere on the field, and he pretends to guide him to the cliffs of Dover, where Gloucester is going to drop himself down. And so Edmund, the bedlamite, the crazy guy, describes, you know, how small the humans appear and how small the little boat. You can barely see the sails. So he's trying to reintroduce him also to the proper scale of things. And then Gloucester jumps. He's actually on a log, you know, and he just falls down. And so that's the death of living in this fantasy world, in this large projection. And then Edmund, as a normal human, you know, once he's overcome his shock, reintroduces him. And Gloucester, his dad, says, oh yeah, I have no right to destroy a life that I did not make, which I think is a basic ecological principle. How can we destroy mountains in Kentucky to get their coal? We didn't make those mountains. How we have, and we don't know how to redo it. Once you've destroyed it, it's gone, right? So reintroducing us. So basically, what Shakespeare is doing is picking up, if you want, a core of the Christian tradition is actually we have to die to our false self, because our false self clings onto false eternity projects, right? And then we have to be reborn to a normal human scale and do our human things within the context of the people that we have, right? And so then in the Christian tradition, of course, reborn is to be there, that you can actually be there for others even if you have to die. And regardless of how long or how short your life is, my brother was 27, he was like a horse whisperer, right? We bought a farm from Mr. Lundy, the husband of my English teacher, and they used to raise Arabian horses, and actually it's the best English teacher ever, because when you went into her living room, if the mare had died, she'd be nursing her little foal with a bottle right in the living room, you know. Anyhow, and so we went to their place often, and they had a young stallion, a two-year-old, not broken, and my brother would just chat with him. He would come on, my brother would go and ride, and my brother hadn't even learned formally. My dad was a good rider, and you know, we all learned it later on, but And the stallion was totally happy with him, and my brother and he just got along. And when the owner came, he just panicked, because as a lot of you who know horses, stallions can be pretty challenging, right? And especially unbroken stallions, you know. And so he panicked, but from brother it was no issue. But anyhow, but so with creatures, and then he was his teacher, and so his connection with all his students was just phenomenal. But it was tragic for his widow. It was tragic, obviously, for his 3-week-old and his 17-month-old child. But in many ways, he had a totally complete life. It just happens to be a short one. But I think he was in all the essential connections to life. So he was part of, you know, not the finite eternities that we create, but of a larger eternity. And my mother grieved hard and fast, and my dad initially was there to support everybody, but then he grieved of course you grieve for the rest of your life in a certain way, but the real depth of grief was probably a year long. He would sit at the edge, didn't want to listen to music very much, you know, didn't really enter into heavy conversations, but it makes sense, you know. Saying farewell to, you know, to your son and all these different things. I mean, that's the worst thing for a parent, right? Because we are the magical helpers, and we can't keep our kids safe.